rules. "You will win no prizes at the games with such pretty strokes," she called as the last log split. He grinned at her. "So this is why my breakfast's late, is it? You're too busy gawking and admiring my fine style. It was a sad day, woman, when you bewitched me away from the fine Farland ladies. The truth of it is, Caswell and my lad, that only a foreign woman would take you. One who hadn't heard the terrible tales of your youth. You've a sharp tongue in your head, but then I could expect no more from Magrig's daughter. Do you think he'll find the house? And why shouldn't he? It's a well-known fact that the Paladins need a map to get from bed to table. You tell that to Magrig when he gets here, and he'll pin both your ears to the bedposts," she said. "Maybe I will at that," he told her, stooping to lift his doeskin shirt from the fence. "You will not," she shouted. "You promised you'd not aggravate the man. Did you not?" "Hush, woman. I always keep my promises." "That's a nonsense. You promised you'd seal the draught from this very window." "You've a tongue like a willow switch and the memory of an injured hound. I'll do it after breakfast. That is, if the food ever sees the inside of a platter." "Do the two of you never stop arguing?" asked Oracle, leaning on his quarterstaff at the corner of the house. "It's just as well you built your house so far from the rest." "Why is it," asked Meg, smiling, "that you always arrive as the food is ready?" "The natural timing of an old hunter," he told her. Meg dished up hot oats in wooden platters, cut half a dozen slices of thick black bread, and broke some salt onto a small side dish, placing it before the two men. From the larder she took a dish of fresh-made butter and a jar of thick berry preserve. Then she sat in her own chair by the fire, taking up the tiny tunic she was knitting for the babe. The men ate in silence, until at last Caswellan pushed away his plate and asked, "How's the boy?" Meg stopped her knitting and looked up, her grey eyes fixed on the old man's face. The story of Caswellan's rescue of the lad had spread among the Farlan. It hadn't surprised them. They knew Caswellan. Similarly, it hadn't surprised Meg. But it worried her. Donal was Caswellan's son, and he was barely 4 months old. Now the impulsive clansman had acquired another son, many years older, and this disturbed her.
"He's a strong boy, and he improves daily," said Oracle, "but life has not been good to him, and he is suspicious."
"Of what?" Caswellan asked.
"Of everything. He was a thief in Arteris, an orphan unloved and unwanted. A hard thing for a child, Caswellan."
"A hard thing for anyone," said the clansman.
"You know, he crawled for almost 2 hours with those wounds. He's tough. He deserves a second chance at life." "He's still frightened of the Aenir,"
said Oracle.
"So should he be," answered Caswellan gravely. "I am frightened of them. They are a bloodthirsty people, and once they have conquered the lowlands, they will look to the clans."
"I know," said the old man, meeting Caswellan's eye.
"They will outnumber us greatly, and they're fighters. Killers all."
"Mountain war is a different thing altogether," said Caswellan. "The Aenir are fine warriors, but they are still lowlanders. Their horses will be useless in the bracken or on the scree slopes. Their long swords and axes will hamper them."
"True. But what of the valleys where our homes are?"
"We must do our best to keep them out of the valleys," answered Caswellan with a shrug.
"Are you so sure they'll attack?" asked Meg. "What could they possibly want here?"
"Like all conquerors," Oracle answered her, "they fear all men think as they do. They will see the clans as a threat, never knowing when we will pour out of the mountains onto their towns, and so they will seek to destroy us. But we have time yet. There are still lowland armies and cities to be taken. And then they must bring their families over from the Southland and build their own farms and towns. We have 3 years. Maybe a little less."
"Why are you always so gloomy, old man?" asked Meg, growing angry as her good humour evaporated.
"Not always young, Meg. Once I was as strong as a bull and feared nothing. Now my bones are like dry sticks, my muscles wet parchment. Now I worry. There was a time when the Farland could gather an army to terrify the world, when no one would dare invade the Highlands. But the world moves on.
Let tomorrow look after itself, my friend, said Caswellan, resting a hand on the old man's shoulder.
We'll not make a dot of difference by worrying about it. As Meg says, we are growing gloomy. Come, we'll walk a ways and talk. It'll help the food to settle, and I know Meg will not want us under her feet.
Both men rose, and Oracle walked round the table to stand over Meg. Then he bowed and kissed her cheek.
I am sorry, he said. I promise I'll not bring gloom to this house, for a while at least.
Away with you, she said, rising and throwing her arms around his neck. You're always welcome here. Just bear in mind I've a young babe, and I don't want to hear such melancholy fear for his future. Meg watched them leave, on the short walk through the pasture towards the mountain woods beyond. Then she gathered up the dishes and scrubbed them clean in the water bucket by the hearth. Completing her chores, the clanswoman checked on the babe, once more stroking his brow and rearranging his blanket. At her touch he awoke, stretching one pudgy arm with fist clenched, screwing up his face and yawning. Sitting beside him, Meg opened her tunic and held him to her breast. As he fed, she began to sing a soft, lilting lullaby. The babe suckled for several minutes, then when he had finished, she lifted him to her shoulder. His head sagged against her face. Gently she rubbed his back. He gave a loud burp, which brought a peal of laughter from his mother. Kissing his cheek, she told him,
"We'll need to improve your table manners before long, little one."
Carefully she laid him back in his cot, and Donal fell asleep almost instantly. Returning to the kitchen, Meg found Corrine had arrived with the morning milk and was busy transferring it to the stone jug by the wall. Corrine was a child of the mountains, orphaned during the last winter. Only 15, it would be a year before she could be lawfully wed, and she had been sent by the Hunt Lord Campbell to serve Meg in the difficult early months following the birth of Donal. In the strictest sense, Corrine was a servant under indenture, but in the Highlands she was a child of the house, a short-term daughter to be loved and cared for after the fashion of the clans. Corrine was a bright, lively girl, not attractive but strong and willing. Her face was long and her jaw square, but she had a pretty smile and wore it often. Meg liked her.
"Beth Yield is down again," said Corrine. "I think it's that damned hound of Boland's. It nipped our leg, you know. Caswellan should chide him about it."
"I'm sure that he will," said Meg. "Would you mind seeing to Donal if he wakes? Have a mind to collect some herbs from the pot?"
"Would I mind? I'd be delighted. Has he been fed?"
"He has, but I don't doubt he'll enjoy the warm oats you'll be tempting him with," said Meg, winking. Corrine grinned.
"He's a healthy eater, to be sure. How's the Lowland boy?"
"Healing," Meg told her. "I'll be back soon." Lifting her shawl cloak from the hook by the door, Meg swung it about her shoulders and stepped out into the yard. Corrine placed the last of the stone jugs by the wall, hefted the empty bucket, and walked out to the well to wash it clean. She watched Meg strolling towards the pasture woods, admiring the proud, almost regal movements and rare animal grace that could not be disguised by the heavy woolen skirt and shawl. Meg was beautiful. From her night dark hair to her slender ankles, she was everything Corrine would never be. And yet she was unconscious of her beauty, and that, more than anything, led Corrine to love her. Meg enjoyed walking alone in the woods, listening to the birdsong and revelling in the solitude. It was here that she found tranquillity. Caswellan, despite being the love of her life, was also the cause of great turmoil. His turbulent spirit would never be content with the simple life of a farmer and cattle breeder. He needed the excitement and the danger that came from raiding the herds of neighbouring clans, stealing into their lands, ghosting past their sentries. One day, they would catch and hang him. "You'll not change him, Meg," she thought. Caswellan had been a child of the mountains, born out of wedlock to a flighty maid named Myra, who had died soon after childbirth, supposedly of internal bleeding, though clan legend had it that her father poisoned her. She had never divulged the name of her lover. Caswellan had been raised in the house of the hunt lord, Pardris, as foster brother to Campbell. The two boys had never become friends. At 17, Caswellan left the home of Pardris with a dagger, a cloak, and 2 gold pieces. Everyone had assumed he would become a crofter, eking out a slender existence to the north. Instead, he had gone alone to Palladies land and stolen a bull and 4 cows. From the Hasten he stole 6 cows, selling 3 in Arteris. Within a year, every outclan huntsman watched for Caswellan of the Farlan. Magrig, the Palladies hunt lord, offered 2 prize bulls to the man who could kill him. Caswellan stole the bulls. At first his fellow clansmen had been amused by his exploits, but as his wealth grew, so too did the jealousy. The women, Meg knew, adored Caswellan. The men quite naturally detested him. 3 years ago, following the death of Pardris, Campbell was elected as hunt lord, and Caswellan's stock amongst the men plunged to fresh depths, for Campbell despised him, and many were those seeking favour with the new lord. This year, Caswellan had even declined to take part in the games, though as defending champion, he could have earned points for the clan. What was worse, he had given as his reason that he wished to stay home with his lady, who had a showing of blood in her pregnancy. He had put her to bed and undertaken the household chores himself, an unmanly action. Yet as his stock had fallen with the men, so it climbed in direct proportion with the women. Now there was the business of the lowland boy, and the almost perverse use of clan law to accommodate the act. How could he invoke Colmach for such a one? The old law, crafted to allow for the children of a fallen warrior to be adopted by relatives of the hero, had never been invoked to bring a lowlander into the clans. Campbell had refused to speak publicly against Caswellan, but privately he had voiced his disgust in the council. Yet Caswellan, as always, was impervious to criticism. It was the same when he caught 2 Hasten hunters on Farlan lands. He had thrashed them with his quarterstaff, but he had not cut off their fingers. That and his marriage to Meg had left the council furious, a slight, they called it, on every Farlan maiden. Against their fury, Caswellan adopted indifference, and in some quarters this fanned the fury to hatred. All of this Meg knew, for there were few secrets among the Farlan, and yet Caswellan never spoke of it. Always he was courteous, even to his enemies, and rarely had anyone in the 3 Valleys seen him lose his temper. This was read by many as a sign of weakness. But among the women, who often display greater insights in these matters, there was no doubt as to Caswellan's manhood. If he didn't maim the hunters, there was a reason that had naught to do with cowardice, and Caswellan's reasons, whatever they were good enough for his friends. Since no answer would justify his actions to those who hated him, Caswellan offered them exactly that. No answer. It was a matter of sadness for Meg that the result of the hatred would be the letting of blood and a death feud between Farlan houses. But that was a worry for tomorrow, and there were always more pressing problems of today to concern the women of the mountains. Chapter 2 Unaware of the controversy of which he was now a part, the boy Galen sat in the cave slowly unwinding the bandage around his head, gently easing it from the line of stitches on his brow and cheek. With infinite care, he rubbed away the clotted blood sealing the eyelid and gently prized the eye open. At first his vision was blurred, but slowly it cleared and perspective returned, though a pink haze disturbed him. By the hearth was a silver mirror. Galen picked it up and gazed at his reflection. No expression crossed his face as he looked upon his scars, but something cold settled on his heart as he saw the eye. It was totally red, suffused with blood, giving him a demonic appearance. The top of his head had been shaved to allow the stitches to be inserted, though now the hair was growing again. but it was growing white around the scar. A change came over him then, for he felt the fear of the Aeneid drift away like morning mist, making way for something far stronger than fear. Hatred filled him, instilling in his soul a terrible desire for vengeance. For 3 weeks, Galen stayed in or around the cave, watching the rain and the sunshine that followed it turn the mountain gorse to gold. He saw the snow recede from the mountain peaks, and the young deer emerge from the woods to the fast-flowing streams. In the distance he saw a great brown bear stretching to claw his territorial mark on the trunk of a wiry elm, and the rabbits hopping in the long grass of the meadow in the pink light of dawn. At night he talked to Oracle, the two of them sitting on a rug before the fire. He heard the history of the clans, and began to learn the names of the legendary heroes. Cubril, the man known as Blacklatch, who first carried the Whirlstone. Grigor, the flame dancer who fought the enemy even as his house burned around him. Ironhand and Dunbar, strong men, clansmen. Not all of them were from the Farlan. That was the strange thing to Galen. The clansmen hated each other, yet would glory in tales of heroes from other clans.
"It's no use trying to understand it yet, Galen,"
the old man told him.
"It's hard enough for us to understand ourselves."
On the last evening of the month, Oracle removed the boy's stitches and pronounced him fit to rejoin the world of the living.
"Tomorrow, Caswellan will come, and you'll meet with him and make your decisions. Either you'll stay or you'll go. Either we, you and I will part friends,"
said Oracle gravely. Galen's stomach tightened. "Couldn't I just stay here with you for a while?" Oracle cupped the boy's chin in his hand.
"No, lad. Much as I've enjoyed your company, it cannot be. Be ready at dawn, for Caswellan will come early."
For much of the night Galen was unable to sleep, and when he did he dreamed of the morning, saw himself looking foolish before this great clansman whose face he couldn't quite see. The man told him to run, but his legs were sunk in mud. The man lost his temper and stabbed him with a spear. He awoke exhausted and sweat-drenched, and rose instantly, making his way to the stream to bathe.
"Good morning to you."
Galen swung to see a tall man sitting on a granite boulder. He wore a cloak of leaf green and a brown leather tunic. Slung across his chest was a baldric bearing 2 slim daggers in leather sheaths, and by his side a hunting knife. Upon his long legs were leggings of green wool, laced with leather thongs criss-crossed to the knee. His hair was long and dark, his eyes sea-green. He seemed to be about 30 years of age, though he could have been older. "Are you Caswellan?"
"I am indeed," said the man standing.
He stretched out his hand. Galen shook it and released it swiftly.
"Walk with me, and we'll talk about things to interest you."
Without waiting for a reply, Caswellan turned and walked slowly through the trees. Galen stood for a moment and grabbed his shirt from beside the stream and followed him. Caswellan halted beside a fallen oak and lifted a pack he had stowed there. Opening it, he pulled clear some clothing. Then he sat upon the vine-covered trunk, waiting for the boy to catch up. Caswellan watched him closely as he approached. The boy was tall for his age, showing the promise of the man he would become. His hair was the red of a dying fire, though the slanted sunlight highlighted traces of gold, and there was a streak of silver above the wound on his brow. The scar on his cheek still looked angry and swollen, and the eye itself was a nightmare. But Caswellan liked the look of the lad, the set of his jaw, the straight-backed walk, and the fact that the boy looked him in the eye at all times.
"I have some clothes for you."
"My own are fine, thank you."
"Indeed they are, Galen. But a grey, threadbare tunic will not suit you, and bare legs will be cut by the brambles and gorse, as naked feet will be slashed by sharp or jagged stones. And you've no belt to carry a knife. Without a blade, you'll be hard-pressed to survive."
"Thank you, then. But I will pay you for them when I can."
"As you will. Try them.
Caswellan threw him a green woolen shirt, edged with brown leather, and reinforced at the elbows and shoulders with hide. Galen slipped off his own dirty grey tunic and pulled on the garment. It fitted snugly, and his heart swelled. It was, in truth, the finest thing he had ever worn. The green woolen leggings were baggy, but he tied them at the waist and joined Caswellan at the tree to learn how to lace them. Lastly, a pair of moccasins were produced from Caswellan's sack, along with a wide black belt bearing a bone-handled knife in a long sheath. The moccasins were a little too tight, but Caswellan promised him they would stretch into comfort. Galen drew the knife from its scabbard. It was double-edged, one side ending in a half-moon.
"The first side is for cutting wood, shaving or cleaning skins. The second edge is for skinning. It is a useful weapon also. Keep it sharp at all times. Every night before you sleep, apply yourself to maintaining it."
Reluctantly, the boy returned the blade to its sheath and strapped the belt to his waist. "Why are you doing this for me?"
"A good question, Galen, and I'm glad you asked it early. But I've no answer to give you. I watched you crawl, and I admired you for the way you overcame your pain and your weakness. Also, you made it to the timberline and became a child of the mountains. As I interpreted clan law, that made you clan responsibility. I took it one stage further, that is all, and invited you into my home.
I don't want a father. I never did.
And I already have a son of my blood, but that is neither here nor there. In clan law, I am called your father because you are my responsibility. In terms of lowland law, such as the Anir will not obliterate, I suppose I would be called your guardian. All this means is that I must teach you to live like a man. After that, you are alone, should you so desire to be.
What would you teach me?
I'd teach you to hunt, and to plant, to read signs. I'd teach you to read the seasons and read men. I'd teach you to fight, and more importantly, when to fight. Most vital of all, though, I'd teach you how to think.
I know how to think, said Galen.
You know how to think like an arterist thief, like a lowland orphan.
Look around and tell me what you see. Mountains and trees, answered the boy, without looking round.
No. Each mountain has a name and reputation, but together they combine to be only one thing. Home.
It's not my home, said Galen, feeling suddenly ill at ease in his new finery. I'm a lowlander. I don't even know if I can learn to be a clansman. I'm not even sure I want to try.
What are you sure of?
I hate the Anir. I'd like to kill them all.
Would you like to be tall and strong and to attack one of their villages, riding a black stallion?
Yes.
Would you kill everyone?
Yes.
Would you chase a young boy and tell him to run so that you could plunge a lance into his back?
No!
He shouted.
No, I wouldn't.
I'm glad of that. No more would any clansman. If you stay among us, Galen, you will get to fight the Anir. But by then, I will have shown you how. This is your first lesson, lad. Put aside your hate. It clouds the mind.
Nothing will stop me hating the Anir. They are vile killers. There is no good in them.
I'll not argue with you, for you have seen their atrocities. What I will say is this. A fighter needs to think clearly, swiftly. His actions are always measured. Controlled rage is good, for it makes us stronger. But hatred swamps the emotions. It's like a runaway horse, fast but running aimlessly. But enough of this. Let's walk a while.
As they strolled through the woods, Caswellan talked of the Farland and of Meg. Why did you go to another clan for a wife? Asked Galen, as they halted by a rippling stream. Oracle told me about it. He said it would show what kind of man you are, but I didn't understand why you did it.
I'll tell you a secret, said the older man, leaning in close and whispering. I've no idea myself.
I fell in love with the woman the very first moment she stepped from her tent into the line of my sight. She pierced me like an arrow, and my legs felt weak, and my heart flew like an eagle.
She cast a spell on you,
whispered Galen, eyes widening. She did indeed.
Is she a witch?
All women are witches, Galen, for all are capable of such a spell if the time is right.
He'll not bewitch me, said the boy.
Indeed they won't, Caswellan agreed, for you've a strong mind and a stout heart. I could tell that as soon as I saw you.
Are you mocking me?
Not at all, he answered, his face serious. This is not a joking matter.
Good. Now that you know she bewitched you, why do you keep her with you?
Well, I've grown to like her, and she's a good cook and a fine clothes maker. She made the clothes you're wearing. A man would be a fool not to keep her. I'm no hand with the needles myself.
That's true, said Galen. Hadn't thought of that.
Will she try to bewitch me, do you think?
No, she'll see straight away the strength in you.
Good.
Well, then I'll stay with you. For a while.
Very well. Place your hand upon your heart and say your name.
Galen,
said the boy. Your full name.
That is my full name.
No. From this moment, until you say otherwise, you are Galen of the Farlane, the son of Caswellan. Now say it.
The boy reddened. Why are you doing this? You already have a son. You said that. You don't know me. I'm not good at anything. I don't know how to be a clansman.
I'll teach you. Now say it.
Galen, of the Farlane, the son of Caswellan.
Now say, I am a clansman.
Galen licked his lips. I am a clansman.
Galen of the Farlane, I welcome you into my house.
Thank you, Galen answered lamely.
Now, I have many things to do today, so I will leave you to explore the mountains. Tomorrow I shall return and we'll take to the heather for a few days and get to know one another. Then we'll go home.
Without another word, Caswellan was up and walking off down the slope towards the houses below. Galen watched until he was out of sight. Then he drew his dagger and held it up before him like a slender mirror. Joy surged in him. He replaced the blade and ran back towards the cave to show Oracle his finery. On the way, he stopped at a jutting boulder 10 feet high. On impulse, he climbed it and looked about him, gazing with new eyes on the mountains rearing in the distance. Lifting his arms to the sky, he shouted at the top of his voice. Echoes drifted back to him, and the tears coursed from his eyes. He had never heard an echo, and he felt the mountains were calling to him.
I am going home, he had shouted,
and they had answered him,
home, home, home.
Far down the slopes, Caswellan heard the echoes and smiled. The boy had a lot of learning to do, and even more problems to overcome. If he thought it was hard to be a thief in Arteris, just wait until he tried to walk among the youths of the Farlane. A lowlander, in Highland clothing. A sheep to be sheared. And being the son of Caswellan would make life no more easy. Caswellan shrugged. That was a worry for tomorrow. For 3 days, the new father and son wandered the Farlane mountains and woods, into the high country where the golden eagle soared, and on into the timberline, where bears had clawed their territorial marks deep into the trunks of young trees.
Why do they do that?
Asked Galen, staring up at the deeply scored gashes.
It's very practical,
Caswellan answered him, loosening his leather pack and easing it to the ground.
They rear up to their full height and make their mark. Any other bear in the vicinity will, upon finding the mark, rise to reach it. If he can't, he leaves the woods, for the other bear is obviously bigger and therefore stronger than he is. Mind you, the bear that lives here is a canny beast, and he can't reach his own mark. In fact, he's quite small.
I don't understand,
said Galen. How then did he make the gashes?
Think about it for a while. Go and gather some wood for a fire and I'll skin the rabbit.
Galen scoured the clearing for dead wood, snapping each stick as Caswellan had taught him, discarding any that retained sap. Every now and again he glanced back at the tree. Could the bear have rolled a boulder against the trunk? He didn't know. How clever were bears? As he and Caswellan sat by the fire, he told the older man his theory about the boulder. Caswellan listened seriously.
A good theory, he said at last, but not true.
Now, look around you and describe your setting.
We are in a hollow where our fire cannot be seen, and there is protection from the wind.
But exactly where in the hollow are we? Taking his bearings from the mountains, as Caswellan had taught him, the boy answered with confidence, "We're at the north end."
"And the tree? Who's it placed?"
"It is growing 10 paces into the hollow."
"Where does the wind come from in the winter? The freezing wind?"
"From the north," answered Galen.
"Picture the hollow in winter," prompted the clansman.
"It would be cold, though sheltered and snow-covered."
"How then did the bear make his mark?"
"I see it!" yelled Galen. "The wind whipped the snow into the hollow, but it built up against the bole of the tree like a huge step, and the bear climbed up the snow."
"Very good."
"But was that just luck? Did the bear intend to fool other bears?"
"I like to think so," said Caswellan. "You see, bears tend to sleep through the winter. They don't hibernate as other animals, they just sleep a lot. Mostly a bear will only come out in winter if it's hungry, and then it wouldn't be thinking about territorial marks. But the lesson for you, Galen, my lad, is not about the bear. It's about how to tackle a problem. Think it through, all the way. A question about the land involves all 4 seasons.
As Galen rolled into his blankets that night, beneath the hide roof Caswellan had made, his mind overflowed with the knowledge he had gained. A horse always kicks the grass back in the direction from which it has come, but the cow pushes it down in the direction it is facing. Deer avoid the depths of the forest, for they live on saplings and young shoots which only grow in strong sunlight, never in the darkened depths. Never kill a deer on the run, for in its terror its juices flood the muscles, making it tough and hard to chew. Always build your fire against a cliff wall or fallen tree, for the reflected heat will double its warmth. That, and the names of all the mountains, floated through his mind, and his sleep was light, his dreams many. He awoke twice in the night, once as it began to rain, and the second time when a large fox brushed against his foot. In the moonlight the beast's face seemed to glow like some hellish demon of the dark. Galen screamed, and the fox fled. Caswellan did not stir, though in the morning as he packed their makeshift tent, he told Galen grimly,
"In the mountains, a man can pee with his life for a moment's panic. That was a good lesson for you. In future, make no noise when faced by a threat. You could have been hiding from the Aenir and felt a snake upon your leg. One scream, one sudden movement, and you would face death from both."
"I'm sorry. It won't happen again."
Caswellan ruffled the boy's hair and grinned.
"It's not a criticism, Galen. As I said, it's a valuable lesson." Throughout the morning, the companions followed the mountain paths and trails. Galen listened to the older man's stories of the clans and learned. He learned of the Farlan march to the island of Valon and the mysterious gates and their entry to the mountains. He learned of the structure of the society and how no kings were permitted within the clans, but that in times of war a high king would be elected, a man like the legendary Ironhand. But most of all, he learned of Caswellan, of the Farlan. He noticed the smooth, confident manner in which he moved and spoke, the gentle humour in his words, the authority in his statements. He learned that Caswellan was a man of infinite patience and understanding, a man who loved the high country and its people, despite lacking the harsh, cruel quality of the former and the volatile, often violent passions of the latter. Towards the afternoon, Caswellan led the way into a small pine wood, nestling against the base of a towering rock face. As they entered the trees, the clansmen stopped and Galen started to speak, but Caswellan waved him to silence. They could hear the wind swishing the leaves above them, and the rustle of small animals in the dry bracken. But inlaid into the sounds was an occasional squealing cry, soft and muted by the trees like an echo. Caswellan led the boy to the left, pushing his way through intertwined bushes until they reached a larger clearing at the base of the cliff. Here, before the cave mouth, lay the evidence of a mighty struggle. A dead mountain lion was locked in a grotesque embrace with a huge dog, the like of which Galen had never seen. The dog's jaws were clamped together in the throat of the lion, which in its death throes had disemboweled the hound with the terrible claws of its hind legs. The dead animals had already begun to putrefy, the lion's belly bloated with gases.
"What kind of hound is that?" asked Galen.
"The best there is," answered Caswellan. "That is Nabara, the warhound. She belonged at one time to Campbell, the Farlan hunt lord, but she was a vicious beast, and she ran away to the hills the day before she was to be slain."
Galen walked close to the bodies. "The jaws are huge, and her body is long. She must have been formidable," he said.
"There are few warhounds left now. I don't know why. Maybe because we don't have the old-style wars. But yes, they are formidable. Terrifying, in fact. As you see, they can even be a match for a lion."
The squealing began again from within the cave.
"Her cubs are inside," said Caswellan. "That is why she fought to the death. Little good it will do them."
"Are you going to kill them?"
"Yes."
"But why?"
"She's been living in the mountains for over a year. The only animal she's likely to have mated with is a wolf, but we'll see."
The cave ceiling was low, and the companions entered warily on hands and knees. Inside, the cave narrowed into a short tunnel bearing right. Beyond that was a deep cleft in which the hound had left her pups. There were five small bodies, and a sixth, struggling to stand on shaking legs. Caswellan reached over, lifted the black and grey pup, and passed it back to the boy. Then he checked the bodies. All were dead. Once back in the sunlight, Caswellan retrieved the pup, tucking it half into his tunic, where his body heat would warm it.
"Build a fire over there, Galen, and we'll see if the beast is worth saving."
Galen built a small circle of stones, laid his tinder, and struck sparks from his dagger and a small flint block. The tinder began to smoke. He blew on it softly until the first tongue of flame rose, then he added small twigs and finally thinner sticks. Caswellan eased his pack from his shoulders, pulling out the strips of dried meat packed by Meg.
"We need a pot to boil some thick broth," he said, "and here's another lesson for you. Cut me a long strip of bark from that tree over there."
Galen did as he was bid, and watched amazed as Caswellan shaped the edges and then twisted the bark into the shape of a deep bowl. Half filling it with water from the canteen, he laid the pot on the small fire.
"But it will burn away," said Galen. "It is wood."
"It will not burn as long as water is in it and the flames stay below the water line."
Taking his dagger, Caswellan sliced the dried meat into chunks and added them to the pot. Before long, the stew began to bubble and steam, the meat expanding. Caswellan added more meat, stirring the contents with his dagger. Galen moved beside him, reaching to stroke the small dark head poking out from Caswellan's tunic. As the sun sank behind crimson clouds, bathing the mountain peaks in glowing copper, Caswellan ordered the lad to remove the bowl and allow the stew to cool. As they waited, the clansman opened his tunic and lifted the pup to his lap. Then he cut a section of the dried beef and began to chew it.
"Can you give some to the pup?" pleaded Galen. "He is starving."
"That's what I'm doing, boy. It's too tough for him. I'm doing what his mother would do."
Removing the half-chewed meat from his mouth, Caswellan shredded it and offered a small amount to the pup. Its tiny tongue snaked out, nose wrinkling at the smell of the meat. The tiny beast ate a little. Then its head sank against Caswellan's hand.
Still too tough for him, said the clansman. But see the size of his paws. He will be big, this one. Here, hold him.
The pup began to whine as Caswellan passed him over, but he settled down as Galen stroked behind his floppy ears.
As I thought, he's half wolf, said the clansman, but there's enough dog in him to be trained, I think. Would you like to keep him?
Galen lifted the pup to his face, staring into the tiny brown eyes. Like him, the helpless beast was an orphan, and he remembered his own long crawl to the high ground.
He is a child of the mountains, said Galen. I shall adopt him. Is it my right?
It is, said Caswellan gravely. But first, he must live.
After a while, Caswellan tested the stew. When it had reached blood heat, he passed it to Galen.
Dip your smallest finger into it, and get the beast to lick it. He's obviously too young to take it any other way.
The stew was thick and dark, and Galen followed the instructions. The pup's nose wrinkled again at the smell, but its tongue licked out. The boy continued to feed the animal, until at last it fell asleep in his arms. Do you think it will live?
I don't know. Tomorrow we'll have a better idea.
I hope it does, Caswellan.
Hope is akin to prayer, said the clansman, so perhaps it will.
He rose to his feet.
Wait here. There's something I must check. I should not be long.
With that he was gone into the undergrowth. The sun had set, but the moon was high and bright in the clear sky, and Galen sat with his back against a tree, staring into the flickering coals of the fire. This was life. This was a peace he had never known. The little pup moved in its sleep, and he stroked it absently. In the distance, the mountains made a jagged line against the sky like a wall against the world, deeply comforting and immensely reassuring. Caswellan returned silently and sat beside the boy.
We have a small problem, Galen, he said. I saw a couple of footprints at the edge of the woods as we entered, but I was intent on finding the cub. I have followed the track to softer ground where the prints are clearer. There is no doubt they are made with iron-studded boots. Clansmen all wear moccasins.
Who made the footprints, then?
The Anir. They are in the mountains.
In the morning, as Galen fed the pup the remains of the stew which had been warmed on the glowing coals of the fire, his mind was clear. The terror of the night condensed and controlled into a manageable apprehension. How many are there? He asked the clansman.
Somewhere in the region of 20. I think they're just scouting, but they're headed into Farland lands, and that could prove troublesome. We will walk warily today, avoiding the skylines. Have no fear, though, Galen, for these are my mountains, and they shall not surprise us.
Galen took a deep breath, and his gaze was steady as he met Caswellan's eyes. I am not afraid today, he told the clansman. Last night I was trembling. Today I am ready.
Good,
said Caswellan, gathering up his quarterstaff and looping the straps of the pack across his shoulders.
Then let us put the Anir from our minds, and I will show you something of rare grandeur.
What is it?
Do not be impatient. I'll not spoil it with words.
The clansmen set off towards the west, and Galen gathered up the pup and followed him. Throughout the morning they climbed through the timberline, over rocky scree slopes, down into verdant vales, and finally up into a sandstone pass. A sound like distant thunder growled in muted majesty, and Galen's heart hammered. "Is it a beast?" he asked.
"No, though legends have it otherwise. What you are about to see is the birthplace of many myths. The rainbow bridge to the home of the gods is but one that springs from Atafos."
Once through the pass, Caswellan led the way along a grassy track, the thunder growing below and to the right. Finally, they climbed down towards the noise, clambering over rocks and warily walk sliding down scree slopes, until Caswellan heaved the pack from his shoulders and beckoned the boy to him. Caswellan was standing on the lip of a slab-like ledge. As Galen approached, he saw for the first time the glory of Atophos, and he knew, deep in his heart, that he would never forget the moment. There were three huge falls, the water split by two towering boulders before plunging 300 feet to a foaming pool beneath, and on to one great waterfall whose roar deafened the watchers. Sunlight reflected from the black basaltic rock, forming rainbows in the spray, one of which spanned the falls and disappeared high in the air above the mountains. The falls were immense, almost half a mile wide. Galen stood open-mouthed and stared at the rainbow bridge. Even in Arteris, he had heard stories of it. Caswellan lifted his arms to the sky and began to speak, but the words were whipped from his mouth by the roaring voice of Atophos. The clansman turned to the boy and grinned.
"Come on!" he bellowed.
Slowly they worked their way above the falls to sit beside the surging water in the lee of a rock face that deadened the cacophonous noise. Caswellan pointed to a tear-shaped island in the center of the lake. It was heavily wooded, and from here the boy could see the mouths of deep caves in the rocky hills above the tree line.
"That is Valen," he said, "and upon it lies one of the magic gates through which the Farlan passed hundreds of years ago. We came in winter, when the water was frozen solid, and we walked upon the ice."
They stayed the night above the falls, and Galen fed the pup with dried meat which he had first chewed to softness. This time the hound ate with relish. The following day, Caswellan led them south, towards the Farlan. The boy saw that Caswellan moved more cautiously, scanning the surrounding countryside and waiting in the cover of woods, checking carefully before moving out into open country. Twice they came upon a near tracks, and once the remains of a campfire. Caswellan worked his fingers into the grey ash and down into the earth beneath.
"This morning," he said, "be watchful."
That night they made camp in a narrow cave and lit no fire. At first light they moved on. Caswellan was uneasy.
"They're close," he said. "I can almost smell them. To be honest, Galen, I am worried. I may have underestimated these anear. For all that they are 20 of them, they leave little spoor, and they avoid the skylines in their march. They are woodsmen and good scouts, and that concerns me. It could mean the anear are preparing to march upon us far more early than I anticipated."
By dusk, Caswellan's unease had become alarm. He didn't talk at all but checked the trail many times, occasionally climbing trees to scan the horizon. "What is wrong?" Galen asked him as he pored over a near-invisible series of scuffs and marks on the track.
"They have split up into small parties. Three have gone ahead, the rest have moved into the woods. My guess is that they know we are close, and they have formed a circle round us."
"What can we do?"
"We do not have many choices," said the clansman. "Let's find a place to make camp."
Caswellan chose a spot near a stream where he built a small fire against a fallen trunk, and the two of them ate the last of the food Meg had prepared. Once again the night sky was cloudless, the moon bright. Galen snuggled into his blankets with the pup curled against his chest, and slept deep and dreamlessly, until about 2 hours before dawn, when Caswellan gently shook him awake. Galen opened his eyes. Above him knelt Caswellan, a finger held to his lips, commanding silence. Galen rose swiftly. Caswellan pointed to the pup, and the boy picked it up, tucking it into his tunic. The clansman filled Galen's bed with brush and covered it with a blanket. Then he added fuel to the fire before moving into the darkness of the woods. He stopped by a low, dense bush in sight of the clearing and the flickering fire. Putting his face close to Galen's ear, he whispered,
"Crawl into the bush and curl up. Make no sound, and move not at all. If the pup stirs, kill it."
"I am willing to fight," whispered Galen.
"Willing, but not yet ready," said Caswellan. "Now, Do as I bid. Dropping to his knees, Galen crawled into the bush, pushing aside the branches and wrapping himself in the cloak Caswellan had given him. He waited, with heart hammering, his breath seeming as loud as the Atafos thunder. Caswellan had disappeared. For more than an hour there was no sign of hostile movement in the woods. Galen was cramped and stiff, and the pup did stir against him. Gently he stroked the black and grey head. The tiny hound yawned and fell asleep. Galen smiled, then froze. A dark shadow had detached itself from the trees not 10 paces from the bush. Moonlight glistened on an iron-rimmed helm and flashed from a sword blade in the man's hand. The warrior crept to the edge of the clearing, lifted his sword, and waved it, signalling his companions. His view partly screened by leaves and branches, Galen could just make out the assault on the camp. 3 warriors ran across the clearing, slashing their swords into the built-up blankets. As the boy watched, the Aeneir drew back, realizing they had been fooled. No word passed between them, but they began to search the surrounding trees. Galen was terrified. The bush stood alone out in the open, plainly in sight of the 3 hunters. Why did Caswellan leave him in such an exposed place? He toyed with the idea of crawling clear and running, but they were too close. One of the warriors began to search at the far side of the clearing, stepping into the screen of gorse. Galen's eyes opened wide as Caswellan rose from the ground behind the warrior, clamped a hand over his mouth, and sliced his dagger across the man's throat. Releasing the body, he turned and ducked back into the gorse. Unsuspecting, the remaining hunters checked to the west and east. Finding nothing, they moved towards the bush, where Galen sat rigid with fear. The first warrior, a burly man in bearskin tunic and leather breeches, turned to the second, a tall, lean figure with braided black hair.
"Fetch Chorus," said the first.
The warrior moved back towards the clearing, while the leader walked towards Galen's hiding place. The boy watched in amazement. The man never once looked down. It was as if he and the bush were invisible. The warrior was so close that Galen could see only his leather-clad legs and the high-laced boots he wore. He did not dare look up. Suddenly, the man's body slumped beside the bush. Galen started violently but stopped himself from screaming. The Aeneir lay facing him, his dead eyes open, his neck leaking blood onto the soft earth. The dead man began to move like a snake, only backwards. Galen looked up. Caswellan had the man by the feet and was pulling him into the undergrowth. Then, dropping the body, the clansman vanished once more into the trees. The last Aeneir warrior, sword in hand, stepped back into the clearing.
"Asta," he called. "Chorus is dead. Come back here."
Caswellan's voice sounded, the words spoken coldly.
"You're all alone, my bonnie."
The warrior spun and leapt to the attack, long sword raised. Leaning back, Caswellan swiveled his quarterstaff, stabbing it forward like a spear. It hammered into the warrior's belly, and with a grunt he doubled over, his head speeding down to meet the other end of the iron-capped staff. Hurled from his feet, he hit the ground hard. Groggy, he tried to rise. Strong fingers lifted him by his hair, ramming his face into the rough bark of an old oak. He sank to the ground once more, semi-conscious. Ongis could feel his hands being tied, but could find no strength to resist. He passed out then, returning to consciousness some hours later, for the sun had risen. His head ached, and he could taste blood in his mouth. He tried to move, but he was bound to a tree trunk. Several paces before him sat the 2 he had been tracking, the man and the boy. Both were obviously clan, but there was something familiar about the lad, although the warrior couldn't place him.
"I see you're back with us," said the clansman. "What is your name?"
"Ongist, son of Asbedag."
"I am Caswellan of the Farlan. This is my son Galen." "Why have you not killed me?"
"I like a man who makes his point swiftly," said Caswellan. "You are alive by my whim. You are here to scout Farlan lands. Your instructions were probably to remain unseen, or kill any who discovered you.
in which case you have failed twice. You had us encircled, and the circle is now tightening. Therefore, if I leave you here, you will be found, and you can give this message to your leaders. Leave now, for I shall summon the Farlan hunters before the day is out, and then not one of you will live to report to your lord.
Strong words, muttered the Aenea. Indeed they are, my friend. But understand this. I am known among the Farlan as a mild-mannered man, and the least of warriors, and yet two of your men are slain, and you are trussed like a waterfowl. Think what would happen if I loosed 200 war-carls upon you.
What are your 200? Spat the warrior. What are your 2,000 compared to the might of the Aenea? You will be like dry leaves before a forest fire. The Farlan, a motley crew of semi-savages with no king and no army. Let me advise you now. Send your emissaries to the Lord Aspidag in Atoris, and make your peace. But bring presents, mind. The Lord Aspidag appreciates presents.
Caswellan smiled.
I shall carry the words of your wisdom to the Farlan Council. Perhaps they will agree with you. When your men find you, tell them to head south. It is the fastest way from the Farlan.
The warrior hawked and spat.
Look at him, Galen. That is the Aenea. That is the race that has terrorized the world. But for all that, he's merely a man who smells strong, whose hair is covered in lice, and whose empire is built on the blood of innocents. Warriors. As you saw last night, they're just men with little skill, except in the murder of women or the lancing of children.
Ongist's eyes flashed in recognition.
The boy was the lad Aspidag had speared at the gates of Arteris. He bit his lip and said nothing. His brother Tostig had told them all how the boy had crawled to the mountains and been rescued by 20 clansmen. It had worried Aspidag. Would you like to kill him, Galen?
Ongist felt the hatred in the boy's gaze, and he stared back without fear.
I see we made our mark upon you, boy, he sneered. Do they call you Blood-Eye or Scarface?
The boy said nothing, but the cold gaze remained.
Did someone cut your tongue out? Hissed Ongist.
Galen turned to his father.
Yes, I want to kill him, he said.
But not today. The man and the boy left the clearing without a backward glance, and Ongist settled back to wait for his brother and the others. It was nearing midday when the Aenea found him. They cut him loose and hauled him to his feet. His brothers Tostig and Drada supported him, for his head was dizzy and his vision blurred as he stood.
What happened? Asked Drada,
his elder by 3 years.
The clansman tricked us. He killed Karis and Asta.
I know. We found the bodies.
He told me to leave Farlan lands. He says he will alert their hunters.
Good advice, said Drada.
Aspidag will be angry, muttered Tostig.
Ongist rubbed at his bruised temple and scowled. Tostig was the largest of the brothers, a towering brute of a man with braided yellow hair and broken teeth. But he was also the most cautious, some would say cowardly. Ongist despised him.
What was he like? Asked Drada.
Ongist shrugged.
Tall, moved well, fought well, confident.
Then we'll take his advice. Did you talk to him, try to bait him?
Yes.
And?
No reaction, he just smiled. I told him the Aenea would sweep his people away. I advised him to come to Aspidag and beg for peace. He just said he would take my words of wisdom to the council.
Damn, said Drada. I don't like the sound of that. Men who don't get angry make the worst enemies.
Ongist grinned, draping his arm over Drada's shoulder.
Always a thinker, brother. By the way, the boy he claimed was his son is the same lad father speared at the city gates.
Drada swore.
And still he didn't get angry?
That does make me shiver. I thought you'd enjoy that, said Ongist,
By the way, Tostig, how many men did you say rescued the boy?
I couldn't see them all. They were hidden in the bushes.